Coming up on Weekend America.
Baseball season starts this weekend. I hope the players show up.
She told me, you better get up. You got to go pitch. I said, pitch? I pitch tomorrow. Hell, what are you talking about? She grabbed the paper, brought me the sports page, and showed me, boom. I said, oh, wow. What happened to yesterday?
The story about drugs and baseball that will blow your mind. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. Remember why you went to your alma mater?
There was someone who could get me the drugs I wanted, and that person lived in Minneapolis, so going to Augsburg was the logical next step for my addiction.
A college program for students with a major addiction. Later, why sports fans are so superstitious.
I mean, I think that we like to believe that we're rational people, and therefore that we don't believe in magic.
Keep your fingers crossed that Week in America will be back after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to the weekend. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And in St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper. The nonstop parties on Florida beaches are going to end soon as most college students return from spring break. But for some students, that just means that they'll move the party back to campus. After all, what would college be without keggers and binge drinking? Maybe it would be a healthier place. Later this hour, we go to a Minnesota school where some students have decided that there's no better place than college to learn how to get sober. What are you doing this weekend?
I am winging it. I like to live spontaneously.
This weekend, I'm actually going to look at houses.
I will be going to my hometown, Kalamazoo, to hang out with some friends.
We are heading out to Montana. Spring break's next week, so we're going to go out and go skiing and stuff.
This weekend, I'm just spending the time up here with my cousins. I'm originally from Mobile, Alabama. I think we're going to watch him play soccer. He plays for a soccer club around here.
I am recovering from a week in Palm Springs. I am going to decompress. I'm not doing a whole lot of much.
I like that, not doing a whole lot of much.
Those voices came from Seattle, St. Paul, and Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Well, tonight, cities across America will go dark for an hour, Earth Hour, to raise awareness of climate change. Meanwhile, this is also the first day of National Dark Sky Week. The organizers want you to snuff out unnecessary outdoor lights to cut down on light pollution. And why does this matter so deeply to them? I'd like you to meet the board president of the International Dark Sky Association, Bob Gent, in Tucson, Arizona. Bob, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you.
Why does a dark night sky mean so much to you?
Well, I moved to Phoenix, Arizona when I was a baby. My parents moved out there. And I remember in the early years growing up, walking into the backyard and looking up at a beautiful night sky. It was full of thousands and thousands of stars. The Milky Way was visible. Galaxies and clusters were visible. So it was really a fascinating time to grow up in Phoenix. But at night, when I went out and saw all these stars, I was immediately inspired, and I had so many questions. How far away are those stars? What are they made of? Can we visit them? Is there a last star? Well, that is a very humbling experience to realize the vastness of the universe and that we're just one little tiny point here on a pale blue dot on Earth. And so from those early years, I was always inspired to study the night sky.
I bring my daughter out regularly to the backyard, and we look at the stars and the moon. But we don't have anything like that vision that you just described.
Yeah, unfortunately, all across the world, everywhere, all the cities are getting bigger and brighter. I lived 11 years in the Washington D.C. metro area. We were lucky to see five or six stars sometimes because the sky was so bright, just a bright orange glow. And you couldn't see through it to see the stars. So to me, it's a tragedy that we're losing touch with the night sky. But not only that, we're also wasting an enormous amount of energy to destroy the night skies. And we're also disorienting wildlife, migrating birds, sea turtles, and other species.
You know, Bob, I've actually been embarrassed since my family moved into our house that I still haven't put up any lights outside. The neighbors call us the dark house. What if darkness feels unwelcoming?
You know, when I was a boy, I was afraid of the dark, and there were times when my mother had to leave the bedroom lights on, then she'd come back and turn the lights off when I fell asleep. We all fear darkness, But what I like to say is, you know, criminals could fear darkness too. And I think criminals might need lights to see to commit crimes. So just being under a bright, glary light may not be what you need to be safe.
Why do you think that sight that you described of that dark night sky, why does it affect us? Why does it affect you so deeply?
It's an inspiration. It stimulates the imagination. It stimulated scientists, poets, writers for thousands of years. In the Middle Ages, imagine, people would walk around with something called an astrolabe in their pocket, and they could pull this out, look at the night sky, and figure out time and other information about the night sky. Well, we've lost touch with all of that. But also, it's a humbling experience to look at a night sky filled with thousands of stars and to wonder how big is the universe and actually feel that it's unbounded. And that's something that I think is a real tragedy, the fact that we're losing touch with that.
National Dark Sky Week begins this weekend. Bob Gent, what a pleasure. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much.
Bob Gent speaking to us there from Tucson. He's president of the board of directors at the International Dark Sky Association. Now, as Bob said, they are not advocating for total darkness, just good lights, low wattage bulbs, shielded lights that don't glare up into the sky, and be sure to turn them off when you don't need them. This is Weekend America.
The first stateside game of Major League Baseball is tomorrow night. The Atlanta Braves will take on the Washington Nationals in D.C. Allegations of performance-enhancing drugs have stained pro baseball in the last few years. But it's not new to the sport. Many players in the past have routinely taken amphetamines before games. They say Joe DiMaggio drank 10 cups of coffee before suiting up. Today we're going to hear from one of the more eccentric icons of baseball, Doc Ellis. He was mostly on the mound for the Pittsburgh Pirates in the 1970s. Ellis once won 13 games in a row, and he led the 1971 Pirates to a World Series title. But Ellis, now 63, might just be remembered for one of the strangest accomplishments in the history of sports, one that took place in the summer of 1970.
We flew into San Diego, and I asked the manager, could I go home? Because we had an off day. So he said, yeah. So I took some LSD at the airport, because I knew where it would hit me. I'd be in my little area, and I'd know where to go. So that's how I got to my friend's girlfriend's house. She said, what's wrong with you? I said, I'm high as a Georgia pine. The next day, which I thought was the next day, she told me, you better get up. You got to go pitch. I said, pitch? I pitch tomorrow. Hell, what are you talking about? Because I had got up in the middle of the morning and took some more acid. She grabbed the paper, brought me the sports page, and showed me, boom. I said, oh, wow. What happened to yesterday? She said, I don't know, but you better get to that airport.
Shucks. It's all right.
Now, this was in the 70s, and Greenies was Dexamil. That was the drug of choice back then, was a stimulant. Over 90% of major leagues was using Dexamil when I was playing. When I got to the game, there was a lady down there in San Diego who used to always have the Bennies for me, Benzedrine, which is another stimulant. I went out to the dugout and reached up because she was standing over the rail. She always stood over the rail and had a pretty little gold pouch. So I got the Bennies, went on back in the clubhouse, took them. The game started and the mist started. Misty rain. So all during the game was a little mist. The opposing team and my teammates, they knew I was high, but they didn't know what I was high on. Because they had no idea what LSD was other than what they see on TV with the hippies. I didn't see the hitters. All I could tell was if they was on the right side or the left side. The catcher put tape on his fingers so I could see the signals. We had a rookie on the team at that particular time named Dave Cash, and he kept saying after the first inning, he said, "You got a no-no going, a no-hitter." I said, "Yeah, right." And I'd look. Then around the fourth inning, he'd say it again, "Got a no-no going." I look, yep. But I could also feel the pressure from other players wanting to tell him to shut up. It's a superstition thing where you're not supposed to say nothing if somebody's throwing a no-hitter. There were times when the ball was hit back at me, I jumped because I thought it was coming fast, but the ball was coming slow. Third base would come by and grab the ball and threw somebody out. I never caught a ball from the catcher with two hands, because I thought that was a big old ball. And then sometimes it looked small. One time I covered first base, and I caught the ball, and I tagged the base all in one motion. I said, "Oh, I just made a touchdown." I didn't pay no attention to the score. You know, I'm trying to get the batters out. And I'm throwing a crazy game. I'm hitting people, walking people, throwing balls in the dirt. They're going everywhere.
Now we go for the pièce de résistance. We've moved to the bottom of the ninth on a no-hitter, leading 2-0.
It was easier to pitch with the LSD because I was so used to medicating myself. That's the way I was dealing with the fear of failure. The fear of losing, the fear of winning. It's just that it was part of the game, you know. You get to the major leagues and you say, I got to stay here. What do I need?
Everybody in our bullpen is standing and walking around nervously. They want to run and grab Doc. Now, two balls, two strikes, and here's the pitch. Strike three. He got it.
A no-hitter.
They're going after him. He got it. They're mouthing Doc Ellis on a no-hitter.
It was a lovely summer's morning, an off day in L.A. So thought one Doc Ellis, as he would later say. His girlfriend read the paper, she said, "Doc, this can't be right. Says here that you're pitching in San Diego tonight. We got to get you to the airport." So off Doc Ellis flew.
The final score in that game, Pirates 2, San Diego Zip, of course. That piece was produced by Donnell Alexander and Neely Allel.
Amazing. By the way, Doc Ellis now works as a drug counselor, tells us he's been sober for years.
Yeah, but in his day, he was a wild man. Once he went onto the field wearing hair rollers, and he beamed three players of the Cincinnati Reds on purpose before they pulled him out of a game.
This weekend, XM Radio launched a special channel to celebrate baseball's opening day. So they'll be playing interviews and baseball comedy, but also hundreds of songs about baseball players, including this one written by Chuck Brodsky called Doc Ellis's No-No.
There were ripples in the floor. Went out to the bullpen to do a bunch of stretches, loosen up a little, throw some warm-up pitches.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by MassMutual, also the proud sponsor of Retirement Revolution on PBS. Host Paula Zahn joins economists, authors, and financial professionals for Retirement Revolution, Monday, March 31st at 10 p.m. Eastern.
Coming up, Edison is scooped, a basketball star is conged, and weapons from the mouths of babes. Good news, bad news, or no news, next on Weekend America. We'll be right back. This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Philosophers tell us to live in the moment. It's all we have. But what if what you're doing in this moment is reflecting backward on the week gone by? Is that okay? These are heavy questions, Des. Can you be considering the past and yet still be fully alive
in
the present?
What are you talking about?
I grapple with these things because of this segment. If I didn't think that was possible, I wouldn't be doing this regular segment called Good News, Bad News, or No News. I've invited three people to reflect on the week's events with us. They include, this week, author and humorist Patricia Marks. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you.
Essayist David Rakoff. Hi, David.
Hi, Bill.
And radio host Luke Burbank. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Bill.
Our first topic. The New York Times reports that the main American supplier of munitions to Afghanistan's army and police forces is some company in Miami Beach whose president is a 22-year-old guy, vice president, a 25-year-old licensed masseur. The weapons they're selling are obsolete, defective, some more than 40 years old, Soviet bloc stuff, some made in China. Crappy weapons, but is this good news, bad news, or no news?
I think this is good news for recycling. And good news for the other side, and by the other side I mean anyone who's fighting against the United States now or ever consider doing so in the future.
It's terrible, terrible, awful news. And then it's even worse because these guys, AEY, you know, they can't bid on any more contracts and they're essentially shut down. Mm-hmm. But the stuff that's already on order, they're allowed to sell. $155 million worth of shady, corroded bullets are still going to be sent. It's astonishing to me.
It seems to me that so many of these stories seem to follow the same arc, which is America does something really idiotic, and then the New York Times always includes how NATO does it better or Europe does it better.
Yes.
Like NATO has a whole system for this where they test the munitions and they make sure that they're coming from the right places and that they've been properly stored. And it's like I don't understand why we can't get it together. But it's like – basically, according to the story, these boxes show up in Afghanistan with like a rusty ninja throwing star and half of a nunchuck. Did anyone else see Charlie Wilson's War?
I didn't.
No.
This is like exactly like Charlie Wilson's War, except the bad version. It's like Owen Wilson's War.
Drill bit Taylor's War.
Seriously.
Our next topic. Mm-hmm. Researchers have unearthed a recording of the human voice made by a little-known Frenchman that predates Thomas Edison's phonograph by nearly two decades. Okay, first, listen to this 1930s recording of the folk song Au Clair de la Lune. Now this, from April 9th, 1860. Good stuff. The Frenchman made this recording by etching sound waves onto blackened sheets of paper. They've never been turned back into sound until now. Is this good news, bad news, or no news?
It's good news. It's good news because it's so completely interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's good news for the family of this fellow, Scott, who apparently went to his grave thinking that Edison had essentially stolen his rightful glory and immortality for having invented this process.
Right.
You know that generation after generation after generation, this is the abiding myth of bitterness in this family. Mm-hmm. So if it's somehow been recuperated, that's kind of good news. And apparently, Edison himself was kind of a rough character.
And he does have the light bulb.
True.
He does have
true.
The light. He has so many things. And Fred Ott's sneeze.
Well, I think this has to be no news because it's an interesting story and all, but this French guy, I think, can kind of completely miss the point of reproducing sound. I mean, according to the story I read, he really looked down on Thomas Edison because he thought Edison was going down the wrong path with this whole playing sound back thing.
That's right.
Like, he was like, what you really want to do with recording things is have a visual representation of the sound as opposed to being able to hear it back. It's like – and here he actually kind of discovered this amazing process. It's like a guy who figures out alchemy but then just uses it to cover chocolate coins.
This might be very good news for me because this sounds a lot like – my Verizon phone reception. So I just might have something historic going on, especially in my kitchen.
Yeah.
It's good news for American history textbook writers who will get money to update the Edison section.
Yeah, see, does it not feel like bad news that we've been telling our school children, myself included, that the first person to record sound was Thomas Alva Edison, American.
Still true.
U.S. American.
U.S. American.
There
he was the first. No, Edison reproduced sound, but this guy recorded it. This French guy recorded it first onto paper.
Yeah, I guess if by recorded you mean made
get
a representation.
The lawyers.
Well, the record got made eventually. By the way, it took American researchers.
Hey, settle.
Okay.
Hey, man, settle down.
We win again.
That's right.
Suddenly there's bunting in the studio.
Our next topic, the new Vogue magazine cover features basketball star LeBron James snarling, baring his teeth with his arm around the waist of Brazilian model Gisele Bündchen. Critics call the cover racist, saying it purposely echoes the old King Kong movie posters of Kong baring his teeth and clutching Faye Ray around the waist. You've seen both images. Is this debate good, bad, or no news?
I think if you believe in the unconscious, and I consciously do, then I think an image that conjures up a black man being that much of a brute and a white woman being in peril isn't probably something that Democrats need.
Do you think there was any intention there?
They're pretty shrewd. I mean, I think somebody must have brought it up in one of the many, many meetings.
Well, I think that this cover is bad news, and for no one more than Reginald Bartholomew James, LeBron James's great-great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a guy, as a lot of you know, who grew up in segregation. He worked his finger to the bone just to try to give his offspring a chance. And where has it gotten him? I mean, his great-grandson is barely a billionaire who poses on magazine covers with supermodels in a country where only one of the presumptive presidential candidates is a black man. Is this really the best we can do, America, in 2008?
Okay. A sarcastic bad news. David?
I hover somewhere between the two responses. It is not great news, but it's also interesting how much of a Rorschach the whole thing is and how much it really says about the perceptions of the viewer than the actual intent.
Yeah, LeBron James says he likes the photo. He's just showing emotion. And if you've seen the NBA, there's a lot of... I've seen that look many times. The yelling is part of the emotion of the game.
I guess I'm the only one here who hasn't heard of LeBron James.
No, I hadn't heard of him either.
Think Michael Jordan, modern Michael Jordan.
Think about the Stephen Sondheim of basketball.
Of basketball. Thank you so much.
Nice.
Now that I've been painted into my little stereotypical corner.
You rushed there, David.
I can't even come out of there.
That's the news this week. Panel, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Patricia Marks. Her latest book is Him, Her, Him Again, The End of Him. Luke Burbank in Seattle hosts a radio show called Too Beautiful to Live. David Rakoff is the author of Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Still ahead, it's a spring break weekend at the College of Addiction. Stay tuned to Weekend America.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Spring has sprung, and you know what that means. Wedding season. Love is in the air, especially at my house where my daughter Ray is on the phone talking nonstop about boys.
11? If he's, you know, not that much taller than me, then if I'm wearing heels and I'm at the dance and I'm taller than him in heels, that's not going to work. Either he's fine.
Ray's 17, a month away from senior prom, graduation, starting her own life. There's so much I want to tell her as she becomes an adult, a grown woman. I want her to feel good about herself, to love who she is. But her mind isn't on self-examination. It's on one thing, snagging a date for the prom.
So right now, I guess it's kind of between Preston and Christian. But the thing with Preston is that if I were to take the run, that would be Preston's best friend. And I can't do that for him. So then, I don't know.
How am I going to get through to her? Okay, here's an idea. She has to wear a long white gown for graduation. While she's celebrating an educational rite of passage, why not add a ring and stage another rite of passage? A wedding. Ray just might go for it. She's been dreaming about her wedding day for years.
I kind of want him to wear like a white tuxedo with a red shirt. It's going to look really hot.
Well, I'm not talking about that kind of ceremony. I want my daughter to vow to love, honor, and cherish herself long before she walks down the aisle with a groom. I first heard about self-marriage about 4 years ago. A young woman bought a simple dress, found an African priest, got a bunch of flowers, and said vows to herself on a California beach. Wow. When I got married almost 25 years ago, I had never lived by myself. I easily got lost in the juggles of marriage, careers, kids. I disappeared into the family's neediness. I had no idea what made me happy. As our kids got older and started doing their own thing, I found myself in the middle of a divorce. A divorce from my old self. I started thinking about what I wanted. I changed my hair. I changed careers. I changed how I treat my body and respected my own time. I want to make sure that Ray doesn't wake up at 48 and wonder who she is. The idea is that you would get married to yourself.
So it'd be like a nun getting married to Jesus, basically.
Like a nun getting married to Jesus?
Yeah, that's what they do.
Wait a minute. That's not where I was headed. I need some expert help here.
It's about creating a vow that represents who you are, what's important, and where you're going in your life.
That's Ken Donaldson. He's a Florida therapist and he's a life coach. Last month, he conducted a self-marriage ceremony for 24 people. He said that they're all now better equipped to be in a relationship, and he ought to know.
I met my wife when I was 29 years old, and I was like, oh, man, look, and I'm an eye guy. You know, I looked at those eyes, and it was like, oh, my gosh, look at those eyes. They're amazing. And as I got to know her, there was just a real ease in the friendship we had. It was very easy for us to be with each other.
But the week after they married, Ken started grad school and a new career. The stress tore at their relationship, and they divorced after 6.5 years.
Here's the self-proclaimed relationship expert ready to go out and change the world, and he's going through a divorce.
So he worked on figuring out who he was, inspected his old baggage, and finally he learned the art of loving himself.
I have to know where I'm going in my life. I have to have a vision. I have to understand my purpose. I have to know what's truly important to me. When you know that and you live by that, you have married yourself.
That all sounds so healthy. I decided to take one more pass at this self-marriage thing with Ray. After all, Queen Latifah did it, and she told everybody about it on Oprah.
No, because then I'll look like ridiculous.
Why would that be ridiculous?
Because nobody gives themselves a wedding. Just for you, just to amuse you, I'll keep that in the back of my mind.
That means no.
In a nice way, yeah.
Okay, I get it. She has more self-discovery to do before she's ready to commit to herself. But I hope that she gets to know what's in her own heart before she decides to share it with someone else. That would be a true act of love. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This weekend, Miami is hosting a spring break party called Wet Fet. Water slides, wet t-shirt contest, you get the picture. This is spring break for some college students. For other students, this weekend is just another weekend of hard-earned sobriety. We're going now to Augsburg College in Minneapolis, which has one of America's few on-campus drug and alcohol recovery programs. It's called Step Up. The students don't just stay away from drugs. They have to make grades, go to 12-step meetings, keep the residence hall clean. The idea is that if recovering students can operate as a community, then relapse gets less tempting. Reporter Hillary Frank brings us the story of one of the Step Up students. He asked us to use only his first name, Sam.
Sam fell into addiction the same way they warned you about in junior high. At 11, he and his friends were sneaking beers from their parents' fridges. At 13, he started smoking marijuana with the older kids next door, then by himself before school. And at 17, that's when things really escalated. Sam was at his friend's house playing video games.
Like, that was all we wanted to do, you know, playing Halo until our thumbs were sore. So one day my friend had some, you know, powder cocaine, and, you know, I was kind of looking at it like, I know it's bad, but when I see it right there, you know, it looks pretty harmless to me. And we'd all decided, you know, let's all take our first bump. And I remember it's like as soon as that powder went up my nose, it was just like, you know, this is what God wanted for me.
With drugs, Sam could be dark. He was the sullen guy carving the 9-inch nails insignia into his desk. He was the guy who wrote deep, messed up poetry. But he pretty much kept that side of himself secret. On face value, Sam was a jock, a football player, the captain of the basketball team. It was thrilling to think he had everyone fooled. Well, everyone except his mom. By the time he was in college nearby, she knew something was terribly wrong. One day, after a football game, she asked him to stop lying.
I made my mother cry right there. And it was just like, whatever, I'll just blow you off right now. I don't want to speak to you. I have a party to go to, you know, I'm a big deal. You know, that's like really what I thought, you know. It's like going out with the other jocks and we're going to grunt and do keg stands.
I wanted to see what Sam's old jock parties were like. So on a Friday night, I headed to a house off campus where I was told some Augsburg football players lived. The scene was pretty much what I remember of frat parties back when I was in college. Some girls in the living room were dancing and eventually falling over. Around them were some guys on couches, totally zoning out. A scrawny guy came up to me with an absolute citron bottle and offered me a pull.
A pull? A pull.
She doesn't want to shing out.
Another kid put his arm around me and the football dudes pried him off.
Be careful, man.
Then tried to boot him out. The next day, I met up with Sam again. Where would you have fallen into that mix if you were at that party?
I mean, you know, you talked about the people falling over on the dance floor, the people sitting on the couch, the people throwing their arm around you, and you're like, that could have very well been me in all those situations.
At first glance, Sam back in his drinking days might look exactly like your average college binge drinker. But there's a big difference between an addict and a non-addict, or normie, as the addiction community calls them. A normie can walk away from a substance at any time with no symptoms of withdrawal, but an addict keeps needing more. By sophomore year, Sam was into prescription drugs like Vicodin and Adderall. He was doing poorly in school. But he perked up in his psychology class when his teacher brought up a certain concept.
The concept of state-dependent learning.
Basically, that means if you learn something when you're intoxicated, you'll remember it better when you're intoxicated. So Sam raised his hand and asked,
wait, so does that mean if I study when I'm drunk, you know, I should take the test drunk?
Sam did a little research and decided, yes, that's exactly what it means.
And then I went nuts with Adderall. Like, it's like, oh, I don't need to sleep anymore. Oh, I can type 10-page papers the night before. And it also enabled me to smoke copious amounts of marijuana, which I couldn't do normally because I would have just fallen asleep.
And then something happened that turned Sam's life around.
PlayStation 3 came out.
That's right, PlayStation 3. There were some students at Augsburg offering people $250 to camp out at Best Buy and wait for the systems to arrive for 3 days.
It was in November. It was just freezing cold.
The thing Sam hadn't counted on was the first 20 people in line being in Step Up, Augsburg's addiction recovery program. He was afraid they'd try and brainwash him.
I'd go on little walks by myself and come back just red-eyed. Or I would down a bottle, like, out of, like, a Pepsi bottle. And one of them did just, like, nonchalantly tell me, just like, you know, everyone here knows you're high. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm not. It's like, dude, don't worry about it. Like, no one cares. And for me to be just completely miserable and to see all these people, like, they had barbecues. And, I mean, it was basically like a vacation from school. And I realized that, you know, these people are just like me. They're addicts and they're sober and they're loving life.
A couple months later, Sam went to the Step Up office. The director told him he'd need 6 months of sobriety before he could join the program. That meant another semester of living with his jock friends.
I'd wake up and I'd smell pot, beer cans everywhere. You know, obviously someone puked in my sink. People just lying like half naked on the floor.
Sam was appalled. But if this wasn't how he was going to spend his free time, what would he do instead? His new buddies in Step Up gave him some advice. For starters, they said, don't hang out in your room.
It's like, well, where else would I be? It's like, oh yeah, the college has a library. You know, I've never been there before.
Sam spent a lot of time in the library and getting tutored by teachers. Remember state-dependent learning? Sam had been intoxicated when he'd learned how to be a college student, even a high school student. Reading, writing, studying. He had to relearn all of it, sober. He says his proofreading skills still aren't where they used to be when he was high.
Have your musical tastes changed?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's kind of nerdy, but I'm very much into classical music.
When Sam got sober, he got a job stacking dishes in the school cafeteria. After work, he'd go over to the out-of-tune Baby Grand in the dining hall. That's actually him playing Moonlight Sonata. The way he taught himself to play it is pretty remarkable. He'd put one ear on top of the piano, have an earphone from his iPod in the other. This sort of thing would have completely embarrassed the old Sam. But that's true of pretty much everything the new Sam does for fun. His biggest love these days? Theater.
It's just like I can't get enough of it.
He especially likes tragedies, like Chekhov's The Seagull.
I was depressed into my toes in that show, and it's just like there's this powerful, powerful feeling that overcomes me, that brings me right back to the most wretched times of my life.
Sam knows it sounds strange to say that he loves tragedies because they make him feel so horrible.
But at the same time, you know, to see the curtain fall, the lights to black out, it's just an instant sense of relief. You know, it's a beautiful reminder that that isn't my life anymore.
In Minneapolis, I'm Hillary Frank for Weekend America.
Sam is in the Step Up Recovery Program at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. He tells us he's been sober for almost 15 months now. You know, Des, the New York Times wine writer did a piece this week about whether it's better to let your teenagers sip wine at your dinner table or should you keep them entirely away from alcohol in your home.
You know, I do have a glass of wine at dinner, especially when I'm eating out. And then there's cooking. Mm-hmm. I keep uncorked bottles of wine all the time in my kitchen to splash into my recipes. Mm-hmm. And I have teenagers at home, so I'm curious, what did he find out?
Well, the experts that he quoted seem to agree that wine sipping at home is generally fine. Mm-hmm. But the caveat is if people are drinking to excess in your house or if your kid has trouble with moderation, that's a very different story.
You know, that reminds me, there's a widely held belief in the Jewish community that because wine is often served at dinner, it's part of their religious rituals, that Jews aren't as susceptible to alcoholism as the population in general. But I do know that some experts are challenging that belief.
I know that my parents' method worked well. They let me sip their Pabst Blue Ribbon and their rosé, and it was so gross it put me off alcohol. But, of course, it doesn't always go like that. We have a link to the Augsburg College Step Up program. You can learn more about it at our website, weekendamerica.org. Our magnolia and our new citrus trees, little trees, are pushing out flowers. We'll be inhaling those this weekend. On Long Island, I see they're getting Sweetbriar's Rehabilitation Center ready for baby orphaned animals that arrive with the spring. And Weekend America is telling your spring stories.
Yeah, or maybe you're yearning for spring stories, because here in St. Paul, there's hardly any sign of spring yet.
True.
What's it like waiting for the thaw? Tell us your stories about spring. Go to weekendamerica.org. The Cherry Blossom Festival starts this weekend in Washington, D.C. The weather will be about 50, and the trees are in peak bloom. Enjoy! For more weather, here's Weekend America's John Moe.
All cities have things they do especially well. For Fergus Falls, Minnesota, it's traveling back in time to the 1970s. Snow, wind, and 37 degrees won't dampen the fun at Retro Weekend. A salute to all things 70s. Tie-dye classes, fondue parties, Twister, and more. And don't forget the rides. My favorite is Jimmy Carter's National Malaise Roller Coaster. Seattle is moist this weekend, cloudy, some snow, 39 degrees, rain. Depressing perhaps, but thematically appropriate for the Moisture Festival. No, it's not a bunch of Seattleites giddy about drizzle. It's an assortment of jugglers, acrobats, clowns, and other neo-vaudevillian performers. This is not to be confused with Seattle's Rain Festival, which is a year-round event. Late March is usually not warm enough to go canoeing. Oscoda, Michigan's approach? Go canoeing. Clouds, rain, snow, and 39 for the Klondike Canoe Race, a lengthy upstream paddle. There's also a running race in the same rough conditions. And my favorite event, the Sensibly Staying Indoors and Being Glad You're Not Participating Derby. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
If your favorite baseball team is playing this weekend, march three times around the parking lot and don't wash your underwear. Hey, you don't want to jinx them, do you? Keep your fingers crossed for the story coming up.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
From American Public Media, you're listening to Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. For sports fans, March is a great month. This is the first weekend of the baseball season. The NCAA basketball tournament is down to the Sweet 16, and the National Hockey League is skating toward the Frozen Four. That could keep you screaming in the bleachers all weekend. But not all of the cheering that we do for our favorite teams is done in public. And you know what I'm talking about, those rituals you do to give your team the mojo. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark sheds light on sports fans and superstitions.
Ross Cunningham is a sophomore in college and a self-proclaimed super fan.
It really started in my freshman year in high school when I tried out for the basketball team and got cut. Part of it's because I'm too short. I'm only like 5'3". I asked the coach if there's anything I could do to help the team out, and he said, go crazy in those stands, and, well, I've been at it ever since.
These days, Ross goes crazy in the stands at Holt Arena, home to the Idaho State University Bengals. But his rituals and responsibilities as a fan extend way beyond the stands, to the privacy of his dorm room.
I have a lot of songs that I listen to get me going. Anything by Dragon Force, that's a band you'll find on Guitar Hero, like Fire in the Flames, the guitar solos, Fast and Furious.
And then there's this thing he does on game days when he's working his job at Taco Bell. He turns in the direction of the basketball stadium.
Kind of like how Muslims turn east or west or whatever, in the direction of Mecca.
Except instead of kneeling, Ross is holding a can of the energy drink Red Bull.
I'll tap it 10 times. I-D-A. Because there are 10 letters in Idaho State. Roll State. Then I'll raise my drink, and then I'll drink up and get the day started.
And then when Ross goes into the arena, he does the Red Bull thing again in each corner of the stands. Ross says the one time he didn't do all this, the Bengals lost. Of course, they've lost when he did do it, too. He knows the good luck ritual might be meaningless.
But I would certainly feel very uneasy if I didn't do it. If you really believe in something, then there's going to be some sort of mystical aura around it.
We all know people like this. People who need to sit in a special chair, or not shave their beard, or wear lucky socks in hopes of bringing a certain X factor to the game.
My name is Ty X Factor Routon. I have wore the same pair of socks now for 13 years. They're my lucky socks.
Never mind the gaping holes in the bottoms. Ty's figured out how to hook the socks over his big toes to keep them on when he goes to see his beloved Kansas City Chiefs play football. And he goes to every home game. He has to get to the stadium at 6 a.m. sharp. If he doesn't,
then your whole day just seems out of whack and it just doesn't seem right. And usually the outcome, to me, it seems like it doesn't turn out right.
I mean, I think that we like to believe that we are rational people and therefore that we don't believe in magic.
Emily Pronin is a psychology professor at Princeton. She and her colleagues wanted to know how susceptible people are to the kind of magical thinking that Ross and Ty admit to. In one experiment, they brought people into a room to watch a blindfolded man trying to shoot basketballs into a net. They asked the spectators to visualize the man making the basket. And the guy made most of the shots. Afterwards, the spectators were asked if they thought they had a role in the shooter's baskets. Most of them said, yeah, probably. What they didn't know is that the game was rigged. The man in the blindfold?
Actually, he could see through the blindfold fairly well.
In other words, the spectators may have been well-intentioned, but their good thoughts had nothing to do with the guy's streak of baskets. So why do rational people believe in magic? Emily says part of it is just how our minds work. We're always looking for causal relationships.
So if we see a connection between things, like I was thinking about my team doing well and then they did well.
Or I was wearing my lucky Chiefs socks and they did well. Or I tapped my can of Red Bull 10 times and they did well.
Sometimes we can take from that correlation that there's a causal relationship there.
In fact, Emily says our tendency to slip into magical thinking could help cognitive researchers understand how our brains process cause and effect. But there are more emotional reasons for magic, too. Research shows that magical thinking is especially common in times of war or danger. Think how superstitious sailors are at sea. And since we all know sports are little metaphors for life, superstitions are a way for fans to feel some control in a game or a world where they're pretty much helpless.
To the extent that you want to have control over an outcome, that might provide you with some comfort to feel as though you've had an impact on it. There's something that you could do to affect the outcome of the game.
Of course, sports fans probably can't really affect the outcome of the game, but the outcome of the game can definitely affect them. A study at Indiana University found that after Hoosiers fans watched their team lose a game, their self-confidence plummeted. The fans doubted their own athletic ability, intelligence, and, weirdly, their sex appeal. Ed Hurt is the psychologist behind the research.
People after the loss kind of felt like the only people that would go out with them were people who were relatively less attractive.
So people felt less sexy after they'd watched their team lose.
Yeah.
And in case you're thinking to yourself right now, what interesting things these rational scientists have discovered about these irrational fans, Ed has something he needs to admit.
When I watch my own kids who are high school athletes and stuff play, that I do sit on the same side of the court if they won that last game previously.
Ed says, you just don't want to tempt fate. I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Gosh, I am so superstitious when it comes to sports. Root with Ross and Ty in his 13-year-old socks. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Well, that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Angela Kim, Millie Jefferson, Jim Gates, E. Okobi, Philip Stearns, who has Japanese archery practice this weekend, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, David Banks, who might have to sell his kidney for gas to power his boat this weekend, and Tim Bamba.
Also, Rob Byers, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, Michael May, who's camping in the piney woods of East Texas this weekend, and our intern, Shirley Shin. Her last day was Friday. Thanks, Shirley.
Thank you, Phyllis Owens,
John Moe, and Mark
Galactic
Sanchez.
Mark, thank you. Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the program. And take us with you. Get a free podcast of today's show at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. It's your weekend. Enjoy it.
Weekend America is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness online at loveandforgive.org. And made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm on fire. I'm ready to bust a move.
I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend.